Okay, so today is September 10th, 2020, and I am interviewing a representative from the Asian Mosaic Fund Giving Circle about their relief work based on the coronavirus pandemic. So thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell me a bit about your organization? Like, what does your organization focus on in general?
Sure. So we're a giving circle based in Philadelphia, and our mission is to advance the lives and resiliency and the leadership of Asian American Pacific Islanders in the community. So what we do is we fundraise money from our community, either through individuals or through foundations, whether it be corporate or other nonprofits, institutional funders. And then we collect that pot of money. And towards the end of the year, we open up a grant cycle where any Philadelphia area Asian-led or Asian-serving organization can apply for one of our grants. They typically fall around $5,000 each, and we've given around three per year. So we have a grant-making cycle, and then the following spring, the individual donors who have given at least $50 are given a vote in the decision-making process of how our funds are spent. So say if you donate $50, you get one vote. If you donate $100, you get two votes. For every additional $50 donation, you receive an additional vote with a maximum of five votes per person. And we make it such that a person can only vote for one organization one time. So if you have five votes, you can't, you know, put it all into one organization. The voting process really allows our members to, you know, talk not only with their wallets, but also with their vote. They can decide how their money is spent. And it's nice because we can kind of trust that our community has the best interest of the organization at heart. They are often living in the communities. They kind of understand the needs and the issues of our community. And by giving them that power to vote, we're really listening to our community and we're addressing a lot of the issues of our community. So typically our grants are in the $5,000 range and they're all for unrestricted use. We like that because for the grants of our size, we think that reporting and making it restricted it's honestly more work, and we want these organizations to focus more on doing their work and providing an impact for the community. And not only that, because it's unrestricted, we're telling the organizations pretty much like, hey, we trust what you're doing and we're going to trust that you're going to put the money to good use. And we haven't been proven wrong since, wherever. So I think that's, you know, that just says a lot about the partnerships and relationships that we've built between ourselves in AMF and the organizations that we serve and grant.
That's awesome. So what kind of organizations have you been able to give grants to?
Sure. So they range across different sectors. So a lot of them are in some of the arts and culture, education, health and human services. A lot of them provide direct services to immigrant and refugee communities. This was especially a focal point of the COVID relief fund that we established, just because we realized that immigrant, undocumented, refugee members of our community were very much overlooked, underrepresented. They were definitely the ones that fell through the cracks of this entire process. And this was more so in connection with finding government assistance. You know, some may not be eligible for the stimulus check because of certain language barriers. They may not have, you know, been or had the benefit of having the type of information as close to their fingertips as someone who's, you know, English speaking or born here, right? Mm-hmm. So we definitely wanted to just kind of make this as soft a landing as possible for some people if people are falling. And just to say like, hey, we're here for you. We hear you. We understand your issues. And we understood those issues because we sent out a need survey to our nonprofit partners in early April, just to get a scope of the land. We had a general idea just from reading some of the city's reports on how COVID has impacted nonprofits, but to make it specific to our organization and our communities was imperative in how we made our decisions and a lot of the actions moving forward.
That's awesome. Could you tell me a bit more about the COVID fund? Is it directed towards just nonprofits or individuals allowed to apply for it?
So it was directed towards nonprofits. We followed a lot of the same requirements as usual. It's nonprofit or fiscally sponsored organization, Asian-led or Asian-serving in the greater Philadelphia area. And any organization was able to apply. We made it easy for the organizations that had previously been granted one of our awards to kind of put their name into the grant applicant pool. Just again, we wanted to make things as painless as possible, just because we knew that a lot of these organizations and individuals were overworked, overextended, unsure about what their future looks like. So in any way that where we could relieve some of that stress, we wanted to take that extra step.
Okay, that's awesome. And do you allow non-501c3 organizations to apply?
Currently, no. Okay. Yeah, there's just 501c3s and fiscally sponsored organizations.
Okay, awesome, cool. So are there any other initiatives that your organization has started in response to the pandemic outside of the COVID fund?
Currently, we are looking to build partnerships with other giving circles that focus on other ethnicities and backgrounds. So during the COVID fund, we had partnered with the Black Giving Circle, where we fundraised with them and gave 20% of our fundraising to them, because they had a focus on giving to the Black Doctors Consortium here in Philadelphia, which is basically African-American doctors volunteering their time to give COVID tests to people in underserved, lower-income neighborhoods. So some of our funds did go directly to COVID relief there. Others went to the Philadelphia Bail Fund and Philadelphia Community Bail Fund. As we look forward into the last quarter of 2020 and into 2021, we are looking to partner with foundations that have a focus on immigrant and refugee focus. So currently we are looking to, we will have a brief interview or meeting with the Fellows Foundation here in Philadelphia. We'll also look to speak to the Siebert Foundation and Barra Foundation. So these are relatively local, and seeing how we can align our mission with theirs and to develop that foundation funder relationship beyond just giving out money. We understand that we have a special mission in a more select focus area, focusing on the Asian American, a Pacific Islander community here in Philadelphia. So we can definitely look to give to a population where philanthropic dollars hasn't necessarily been allocated proportionately to the population of Philadelphia.
So I've interviewed quite a few organizations, and it seems to be a common theme about taking a mutual aid or a giving circle model to interacting with communities, especially if they're communities you're from. Could you tell me a bit more why your organization decided to take a kind of more community-centered approach?
Sure. So I think a lot of it has to do with traditional philanthropy not necessarily being representative of the communities in our neighborhoods. So let's say Philadelphia's Asian population is roughly 5 to 7%. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily know if 5 to 7% of philanthropic dollars are going towards our communities. So for us, it's really a way for us to fill that gap. provide that voice. And because we have found that certain groups within the Asian communities may not be as civically engaged. And I know for me personally, just from anecdotal evidence, like my family, like this wasn't really something that was a focus growing up. Like, because we were, my parents were refugees coming to the States themselves. They came here when they were teenagers, but they were focused so much so on just surviving. So for us, you know, having that lived experience and understanding like what the rest of the community is going through, it really does give us that background information and how we can help better. I know I'm rambling, but what drew us to making this community based, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times we found that with traditional philanthropy, again, like the dollars weren't proportional. We had a really hard time convincing foundations that the issues in our communities matter. So we had to think about it like this, like if no one else was really gonna listen to us, then we kind of had to get into like a more entrepreneurial mindset and think of how we can still support ourselves and, you know, draw support from them in our own way, such that it feels like both sides are winning, basically, right? Mm-hmm.
So how has your organization worked to build pan-ethnic solidarity? Because one thing I've noticed is the sheer diversity in the number of partners that your organization has.
Yeah, so when we say AAPI, we mean like the whole scope of it, right? So that means not just East Asian, which I think a lot of people think of when they think of AAPI, but we really want to focus on the Southeast Asians and South Asians and making sure that, you know, although there may be some regional, geographic, cultural differences among those groups, that we try to be as inclusive as possible. And I think that was really highlighted in who we gave our grants to. So just kind of looking at it, we gave a lot to like a Cambodian serving organization, Korean, an arts organization, ones that serve Muslim Americans and the Philadelphia area, Vietnamese. So just having that scope and that broad brush of who we reach out to and who we partner with has been so important in how we define and connect the AAPI communities in Philadelphia and how we build partnership with them and basically say that, you know, we recognize your community. We're looking to give back, we've also, or I know, at least I've been educated about a lot of small minority groups that I wasn't even aware existed. So actually one of our grantees last year and one who received one of our COVID relief grants, they represent a very small minority group from Burma. The minority group is called the Karen people. And I had no idea that they had even existed before I joined Asian Mosaic Fund. Mm-hmm. So just really learning more about, you know, what it means to be Asian American Pacific Islander in Philadelphia and how, you know, it's not a monolith, how there are so many sometimes unknown communities, but have such a rich and beautiful culture has been, you know, really rewarding. And I think it really does bring the community together. Knowing that, you know, we're all kind of in this together.
So how have the AAPI communities in Philadelphia responded to your organization?
I think they've responded well. I think they can trust us to be that organization in our area where they kind of know that all of our decisions and actions are informed by their needs and their wants. So that survey that we asked for, we didn't make our actions and planning based on assumptions. Like we asked these people, we interviewed them. When it came to how our COVID relief funds would be divvied up, we actually asked people from these organizations and a couple community members, hey, would you like to join our grant making committee to review these applications and then decide how money is allocated. I mean, giving people, again, that voice and that power, especially since they're so close to the communities that we're serving, I think that really left a really good impression on them. Just knowing that, again, like, we're just saying we trust you to make the best decisions possible. We understand that you have, you know, your ear to the ground, you're seeing these people every single day. I mean, that's not the, like, people within AMF, they also live it and see it themselves, but there are just certain, like, geographic regions of the city where maybe we may not have as good of a knowledge base as we could. So that's kind of where we bring them in and kind of, you know, listen to them. We trust that, you know, the information that we get is, you know, trustworthy, and, you know, it's something that we value greatly.
That's awesome. So how has the coronavirus in general affected your organization and your members and partners? I know you talked about the COVID-19 fund, but mm-hmm. are there other ways that your organization has been affected?
Sure. So I would say that at the beginning of this year, we kind of had like a strategic plan lined up, but seeing how COVID progressed, we realized that we couldn't carry on business as usual. So that definitely impacted the way we recruited, how we fundraised, and how we carried on our normal programming. So for example, normally we would have an event where we would highlight one of the previous year's grantees. We have planned about 3 events in addition to our grantee celebration this year, all of which were canceled. So we had to get a little bit, I mean, we will eventually have those events. They've just been postponed, but looking for ways that we can partner with them, and the COVID Relief Fund was that big initiative. And we've had to focus more on getting donations from foundations and corporate sponsors, just knowing that COVID has affected a lot of people's employment and income. We know that it would be a lot to ask of them to donate again and again, especially when people may have lost jobs or, you know, just things happen with COVID. You know, you never know with, you know, a family's health. So that's kind of shifted that. And then internally, I think this has been one of the more intensive asks of our members or of our volunteers, just putting in a little bit more hours. Previous to COVID, we'd been meeting maybe once a month. During COVID, it was weekly. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely more, we did ask our members more, but our members also recognized that, you know, this is a very special time in the country and that they all rose to the occasion and helped out in the capacity that they could. And we really appreciated that. Yeah, I think we've definitely learned to expand our capacity during this time. I mean, normally we don't really have many overhead expenses. Again, we're all volunteers. We don't have an office space. Everything we do is over the phone, virtually. So in terms of our financials, it hasn't been impacted that much. It's really just how we fundraise and how we've decided to allocate our funding that's kind of been different.
Mm-hmm. So how has your organization maintained a sense of community over the past few months? Because, like, not only are you dealing with social distancing requirements, but there's also literally a pandemic, but then right. There's the additional side of the increased anti-Asian violence that we're seeing across the country, as well as just racial upheaval in general.
Sure. So I would say, like, in the greater AAPI community in Philadelphia, there have definitely been some virtual town halls, some just talks about Asian, anti-Asian sentiment or mental health. You know, I think, like you said, the pandemic has really caused a lot of stress for people, not being able to see their loved ones, losing their job, you know, losing sleep over, you know, if they may be able to pay rent next month. So in that way, it's really been important to create that sense of community. And we do have like a community listserv where we, you know, where different members of the community, no matter what your organization, position level, what have you, you know, they can post like, hey, if you need free resources, go here. If you need food, go there. If you're looking for a therapist because you're dealing with, you know, some heavy mental health issues, you know, here are some resources there. And so that way we've kind of gathered as a community just to say, you know, we're all in this together. We're here for you. And from a more practical side, here's everything that you need to know in order to fulfill your needs in order to get by. I know that a lot of us are in survival mode during the pandemic, but, you know, we try to make it as, I hate to say normal, but as normal as possible. And then from our own members, because we've been meeting so often, we do kind of get a sense of everyone's work style. And doing, you know, weekly check-ins, you know, not necessarily getting, you know, when we have our meetings, we spend like the first 5 to 10 minutes, you know, just going around doing like a healthcare or mental check, see where everyone's at. Just because I know it's so easy to not discuss our feelings and how we're handling everything. And it's just easier to get right into business. But, you know, sometimes it is nice to say like, hey, how are you doing? Like, how's your mom doing? You know, like, how's business? That sort of thing. And we also do have some virtual like social events, which is kind of nice. You know, like a potluck or like a trivia night over Zoom. It's not much, but it's some interaction that, you know, builds that community, that trust. Just saying like, hey, we care about you as a person, not just as a volunteer. You know, we value you as our friend, right?
So have you found more opportunities to collaborate with other organizations that deal specifically with people of color? So I know you talked about the Black Giving Circle. Has the pandemic and being primarily online allowed for more space to interact with other organizations for you?
Sure. Yeah, so Black Giving Circle is probably our first collaboration or partnership outside of the AAPI community groups. Mm-hmm. And I think we're definitely looking to partner with other giving circles later this year or into 2021. I think we just have to do a little bit more research. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure if many of those exist in the Philadelphia area. Maybe we can take it a little bit more beyond Philadelphia and more into, say, the Mid-Atlantic area, right? Mm-hmm. But nationally, we've used our social media to connect with other AAPI organizations. We are affiliated with APIP, which is Asian American Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy. So we follow their national page. We've connected with the national president as well as one of the program coordinators there. And so we're looking to them and looking to work with them on how to create a stronger AAPI community, not just here in Philly, but nationally. And I think what we do locally is important, but, you know, we can definitely build a stronger coalition with other chapters as part of APIP.
That's awesome. So what practices that have been developed during the lockdown do you think that you'll keep once things go back to whatever normal was? So like you talked about the potluck and social media.
Mm-hmm. I think that we will definitely keep our connections with foundations and how we can partner with them for funding. So we had reached out to a few foundations about giving to our COVID relief fund. Unfortunately for them, timing was not great for them, but they did say, hey, you know, in a few months or even next year, like, put your name back out there and we'll consider it, just because I think foundations just work on a more rigid schedule. Mm-hmm. And I think it was difficult for them to kind of pivot for us. But I think because we had those initial conversations that that's something that we look to build for in the future. I think it's definitely allowed us to become better fundraisers. You know, as I mentioned before, we usually gave 3 grants of $5,000. For our COVID relief fund alone, we've fundraised $47,000. So more than tripling what we had done. I think that sets a new bar for where we can go in the future. It was both encouraging and discouraging to see what we fundraised, because we initially set a lofty goal of $100,000, thinking we could get, say $25,000 from individuals and then the remainder from institutional funders. And then slowly we had to drop it down to 75, hoping that it would be, you know, again, 25,000 from individuals and then 50 from foundations. And then just kind of seeing the response to it, it was discouraging, but again, on the upside, we gave 40 something thousand dollars to 9 different organizations,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, were in need, help them, you know, give back their community, put on some programs that would, you know, say like give food to the families. That was really rewarding. So that's something that we can hang our hat on and build off for the future. And I think organizationally, we've become so much stronger. You know, when you're working with the same group of volunteers for several hours a week, every month for the past 5-6 months, you know, that sense of camaraderie, that sense of, you know, being team players, that's grown immensely. And I think with the leadership that we have intact right now, we're definitely looking forward to doing some big things in 2021, pending COVID.
So do you think you'll have another, hopefully it won't be necessary, but do you think you will have another grant cycle just for the relief funds for COVID?
So I think that's to be determined. I think if anything, if we were to do that, it'd be more so in the recovery side. I mean, our fund was called the COVID Relief and Recovery Fund. Mm-hmm. But I think just knowing that, I don't necessarily know how much of a different place we are now than we were several months ago, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, people are still unemployed. Nonprofit organizations are still haven't been receiving the same level of donations as they had been previously. You know, they still, I mean, large events still aren't allowed by local ordinances. So those are definitely large considerations moving forward. And say a nonprofit that usually has a lot of their fundraising done at one or two major events, say they can't do that again in 2021, then I think that is cause for concern and, you know, a red flag for us to say, hey, this isn't, like, things haven't slowed down all that much. Like, organizations and people are still hurting. So I definitely think it's a very real possibility that we relaunch the fund. And I think we can do that concurrently with our normal grant-making cycle for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what have been the biggest relief needs for people in the AAPI communities in Philadelphia?
I think it mirrors a lot of what, you know, we see across the country. A lot of it is, well, organizationally at least, it's general operating support.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, food for their members. It's translation services so that people can apply for government assistance or to even get updated information. So then the example I'll give is that one of our nonprofit partners that serves a Korean community said that there's one Korean newspaper that gets circulated once a week. Mm-hmm. And so if you're getting information only once a week when things are changing constantly, then all of a sudden, you know, you may be missing out on some very valuable information. And I think that can be especially dangerous in a pandemic. And especially for those that don't speak English, that may be their only source of current events. And then for a lot of our arts and culture organizations, a lot of their issues were just proving that they're essential, right? So I think when people think of essential, they think of, you know, your grocery store or your food, your hunger relief organizations, healthcare. But for a lot of these arts and culture organizations, they had lost a lot of funding because people didn't think that they were essential. When in reality, a lot of the mental health and therapy that was helping people was through art and music. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure that we listened to them and made sure to understand that, you know, all of our nonprofit organizations are essential in some way. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any differences across ethnicity, like between East Asians or Southeast Asians, in terms of like need for relief or even how they imagine recovery to look like?
Right. I would say there hasn't been that much of a difference. I think, so I will say one thing is that in terms of hunger relief, it might look different for different communities. So I know in Philadelphia, they were giving boxes of food, so just like the general population. And a lot of the donations weren't really like culturally appropriate or like unfamiliar to some of these communities. So I think that's where it was helpful for us to support an organization that was giving, you know, food that's familiar to these small ethnic groups, right? In terms of the needs, I think translation services are generally needed, but I would say the Korean community probably asked for it. Like that was probably one of their bigger needs. Yeah, I think in the Southeast Asian and South Asian communities, there was much more of a focus on the refugee and immigrant side. Mm-hmm. So I know that one of their Vietnamese nonprofits, that was one of their big things, as well as their Cambodian nonprofits. But yeah, I think a lot of the times it was just, we need funding to stay afloat and to operate and to provide services for our clients. That was generally the overwhelming message.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of how some of your partners, especially ones who are involved in religious communities, are practicing religious rituals given like social distancing requirements? Like I'm thinking about care with Eid. Mm-hmm.
That I'm not sure about. I know the Uri Center Care Philadelphia, they deal with the Muslim community. I'm not too familiar with how their religious practices have been affected in any way. That's something that we can definitely follow up on with them. But I think a lot of, like, if they have to go to Sunday service or what have you, I think a lot of it's done virtually. I know that in the Korean church, they've taken a lot of their services virtually. So, and some of like the Bible studies and their church groups, they've had to update the way they operate. But otherwise, I think people are still able to practice, but it's just in a different format.
Mm-hmm. And have you had many religious organizations apply for your grants, either the regular grants you have or the COVID relief?
We have not. I think that may either just be through not having our name out there as much. But we definitely support religious communities or people in our within the AAPI communities are obviously very pretty religious, whether they're Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, what have you. But no, we haven't really had many. I think CARE Philadelphia is probably the mostly religious organizations that's reached out to us, and we have funded them.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So I know you talked about this a bit at the beginning of the interview, but how would you rate your local government's response to the coronavirus?
Oh.
I know that's a loaded question.
That's tough, yeah. I would say they've been good with hunger relief, just simply a function of having one of the larger food banks in the area in Philabundance. We are facing a homelessness crisis in the area. It's actually, there's an encampment actually not too far from my apartment right now. That's where the city put a deadline that was passed yesterday for them to move out. I think they've been more cautious in terms of reopening, which I think is smart. I know that, for example, restaurants have just been allowed to start allowing customers for indoor dining, about 25% capacity. So I think the local economy is slowly, being reawakened. But I think it's so mixed. I mean, I know in my line of work, like in my day job, things haven't changed much for me, but I know across other businesses, there have been furloughs, there have been layoffs. I consider myself very lucky for the position I am in. But I think locally, it's been hit or miss. I think we've been okay in terms of distancing and local mandates, but I think across the board, it's kind of been like there's been a lot to be desired in terms of response, stemming from national on down.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the government could do to better serve AAPI communities, specifically in Philadelphia?
I think more representation in public office. I think that would be a really good start. We have a couple members of city council who are AAPI, so that's great. But I think just having that representation so that at least members of our community know that there's someone in there that looks like us, that sounds like us, that knows our issues and experiences, I think that goes a long way. In terms of what we could do for us further, I think a lot of the AAPI communities are built on small business. So I know for myself, at least, my parents are refugees here, or came as refugees from Vietnam, and they opened up a small business to kind of like build their life here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of how a lot of families, build a better life for their families too, especially looking at our Chinatowns, our Koreatowns, areas where, there's a high South Asian, Southeast Asian communities. Like a lot of these communities are built around small businesses, and any way to support them would be great. I know that some of them may have missed out on PPP. I would say that would be super helpful. And again, just having government assistance more readily available and culturally appropriate would be a good first step. I had mentioned that about having translation services, but having, mental health services that caters to AAPI communities would be great. Just making it easy for people to get on with their daily lives is probably my main thing, I think, especially for undocumented workers. There's so much of a question mark about where they stand in this country to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then when you put in a pandemic, it just exacerbates the issues tenfold, right?
So how has, you talked a bit about the community building that you all tried to do, especially with the pandemic. How has your organization helped either their own members or the broader AAPI communities in Philly cope with the large loss of life? Because Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have been disproportionately affected by it, especially undocumented.
That's actually one of the questions that we've been asking ourselves. And it's something that while we think about it, we don't really know if we have anything in place right now to effectively cope with it. Mm-hmm. We can have, you know, as many virtual town halls and meetings and group therapy sessions as possible. But I think that's just such a complex issue that would require like definitely more planning. And I think even culturally, talking about death or emotions or the feeling of loss and grief is, I don't want to say taboo, but having that emotional and mental health awareness is something that the AAPI community is still learning. And so I think that's, it won't be an immediate fix, but it's something that we can slowly chip away at in order to better serve our community. It's tough. Talking about death and loss on such a large scale is quite the undertaking. And I don't know if we as an organization, if we're equipped to do that ourselves, or if maybe we can work with some of our partner organizations to kind of develop, I don't want to say curriculum because that sounds very like academic and, you know, folk, or I guess too structured. But we don't have an answer to that yet, no.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if there are any other organizations within Philadelphia working to do that?
I would say the closest thing would probably be like a mental health group. I think there was someone in our community that was looking to provide group therapy sessions or individual therapy sessions to members in our community who is, you know, I believe she's South Asian, but she has experience serving, you know, the full AAPI community. So I think that's probably the big start. And then I think a lot of these communities do often act as, you know, cultural hubs for the community. So they often do act as a second home where they can discuss these issues. So like say, even though they're being administered, you know, immigrant, refugee, health and human services, you know, they can speak with, you know, a caseworker, a social worker to discuss some of these, you know, bigger feelings that they may be experiencing, excuse me.
And so what resources does your organization and even your members need to help cope with the effects of coronavirus?
So we did create a COVID resource page, mm-hmm, on our website. And again, a lot of that has to do with, you know, getting food, getting, mm-hmm, immigrant resources, employment. If they need supplies for their child's schooling, we can direct them to another organization where they're giving out school supplies. And a lot of it has, I guess for us, we're just really trying to bridge the gap from the community to government assistance, or from community to an organization where they're specializing in a certain need and focus.
And then when you were talking about the foundations that you have been able to receive funds from, were those were primarily local or were they national?
One was local and then a couple others were national. So I know that the CRSC and that was forwarded to us by a colleague, well, from one of the members' colleagues. And then we had received a regional grant from the Wells Fargo Foundation. The other was from APIP National Chapter. And the other was from the Aspen Institute in partnership with the Nick Nolte Foundation. So that was a foundation, or national foundation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of our local dollars were from individuals.
Uh-huh. Has it been easier to find money in general from more national foundations compared to local ones?
Based on our numbers, yes. So we had two members from APIP Philadelphia who, they have the connections with these large local funders. And I think a lot of it had to do with just the timing of it all. Unfortunately, they couldn't give money to us now, but we kind of like planted that seed early on. So there's room for it in the future, but I think seemingly national donors have been a little bit easier to receive funding from, for sure.
Awesome. And so would you say that there's anything in your members' life experiences that have helped them prepare for coping with the coronavirus in terms of being able to shift how you all fundraise or how you build community? Like, where are you drawing this like knowledge base from?
Yeah. So I think some of us do rely heavily on traditional philanthropy. But in terms of how we've been, resilient enough to handle some of the hardships that come along with coronavirus, immigrating to the U.S. is really hard, simply put. There are hardships that people go through. There's a lot of adversity. There's a lot of question marks. There's a lot of times when there's uncertainty, hunger, sickness. I'm just drawing from my parents' story of coming to the United States. They felt all of that and then some. Growing up an immigrant or the child of an immigrant, you quickly learn what resilience and work ethic is. And I think that's a really strong start for how we've been able to cope with it. And then to a certain extent, our communities may be a little bit more self-reliant on ourselves and our communities rather than relying on government assistance, simply because we may not feel that government or public officials work for us, just to say that bluntly. And I think we kind of learned throughout this process that local foundations acted similarly. So I think being self-reliant has probably been our biggest source of assistance, just like internally.
That makes sense. And so how many elders are involved in your organization?
Can you define elders?
The generation before you. So I might be wrong in assuming is most of the leadership base either like Gen Xers or millennials?
Yeah, I'd say we're all millennials. Okay. So we do have, I had mentioned that APIP is say we're AMF is here, mm-hmm. APIP birthed AMF. So So like APIP would be like our parent organization, and APIP is like the subsidiary, if you look at it like that. So a lot of the APIP members in Philadelphia are that elder generation. And what's been helpful is, you know, they can impart their wisdom, and importantly, they just have connections to foundations and donors and people that know how to help. Where if they don't know that, they can connect us with someone who does. Mm-hmm.
Hold on 1 second, you muted yourself.
Sorry, I was getting a call, junk call. If we've ever had any issues on like which directions we want to take, or, you know, even in being directed to institutional funders, how we should frame our argument or our case statement, that's all really been valuable information, and how we've kind of had to navigate how we work through our COVID relief fund. So those are our main elders. And, you know, a lot of our community partners, they would fall into that elder bracket. They just have so much information to impart on us, and how they've taught us how we can be better partners, and we've listened.
That's awesome. So in a perfect world, what would you like to see Asian Mosaic do in 2021 and beyond?
I would like to see us match or exceed our fundraising goals. I would like to see us build more internal leadership capacity. I would like to see us recruit more volunteers and to better engage our volunteers in whatever capacity that may mean. I would like to see us partner or continue to build on partnerships with our local AAPI organizations. Again, continue to listen to how we can better serve them. I would like to see us build stronger ties with local foundations. As I mentioned, we had, you know, we're in the process of building that. I would like to see if we can really start to solidify that and turn it from more so acquaintances to better working relationship with them. I would like to see us give out more grants for our local nonprofit organizations to continue giving high quality assistance and services so that we can fulfill our mission of, you know, advancing the well-being of our members. I would love to see if we could shift from surviving in 2020 to thriving in 2021. Mm-hmm. I think it's just been such a long and hard year that we just need a break, you know? Just give like some breathing room, like take the foot off the pedal like a little bit, and, you know, just give us some hope to look forward to in 2021. That's what I would ask for in a perfect world.
Me too. All right. And then, so just last question, we like really breezed through this, is what else should I know about your organization or the AAPI communities in Philadelphia?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is that, you know, the AAPI communities, like, we're not a monolith. So like one of the big things that we put like language wise is that instead of AAPI community, we changed it to communities, just recognizing that, you know, there are so many people in our community, and that, you know, there are so many different needs, so many cultural differences regionally, but that we're special and that we can all come together and be, you know, unified in this sense. I would say that AAPI issues matter, and I think that we have to constantly battle the mono minority myth while still, like, it's the mono minority on one hand while still being like a perpetual foreigner on the other, right? So we're constantly grappling between those two ends of the spectrum. And kind of how we navigate that balance and that identity has really been a struggle. I know for me personally, and I know for many others within the AAPI communities, And so we're still trying to figure that out. But I think people should know that, you know, just because the model minority myth exists doesn't mean that there are real deep systemic issues facing our communities as well. And that when people bring those AAPI issues up, not to brush it off saying, oh, I thought the Asian community was doing so well for itself, you know, just really listen and trust that when we're saying that parts of our community are struggling, like we're not saying to blow smoke or to like really curry favor or power into our side. It's to really educate and inform people that this is what's going on. And we want to bring more attention to that for sure.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and all of your labor. So I'm just going to stop recording now.
Thank you so much, Kayla.
One question.